Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum, featuring timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve is in conversation with Rafael Marti, Executive Vice President and General Manager of Cybersecurity Management at ConnectWise. Rafael is also the author of Applied Security Visualization and The Security Data Lake. He and Steve discuss how to prevent data from being compromised, what government and private enterprise can learn from each other vis-a-vis cybersecurity, the pros and cons of cyber insurance, and more.
Rafi, hi. Thanks very much for joining me on the podcast here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've had a really interesting career in cyber that's given you experience in working across a whole range of different areas. I mean, you've worked with the intelligence community to lead, you know, big data analytics and artificial intelligence projects, and you spend a lot of time as well working with Fortune 500 companies around the world. Tell us a bit about your career to date, though. I mean, what drew you into this particular space in the first instance?
Yeah, I think it was curiosity. When I was super young, I remember sitting at the kitchen table of my grandma, taking her iron apart to understand how it works. So from my childhood on, I was always interested in how do these things work and try to take things apart. And sometimes I could put them back together, not always. But that kind of led into computers. I was trying to understand how they work and how to program them. I studied computer science. And at some point, I took some cryptography classes, and I was fascinated by how you can transmit information between two entities. And if someone is listening in, they have no idea what's actually going on. And that kind of led to the next step of, well, okay, that's securing systems and communications. How does that work? How do you hack into these systems? Because to protect them, you have to understand how to kind of circumvent these different safeguards. And that got me interested in cybersecurity. And one thing led to another. I kind of always enjoyed understanding how systems work and looking under the hood of how this is put together. And to date, I'm still playing around with electronics and Arduinos and things like that to understand how to build hardware systems. Yeah, that's kind of how I ended up in cybersecurity.
So that sort of interest in really sort of getting to the root of things, trying to figure out how things work. You mentioned an interesting point there, though, which may have caused some people to raise an eyebrow there, which is, I think you said something like, you need to get inside the head of the hacker. I'm paraphrasing now, but you know, it helps if you can understand how to break into a system in order to protect it. Tell us a little bit more about that. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so if you imagine any security analyst that's trying to understand what happens to a system, right? Like just say you're monitoring your own computer. You have to understand what's normal. You have to understand what this computer is doing on a day-to-day basis. And you have to understand what it does when you do certain things to it. If you open an application, if you are connecting to a website, what is normal for that computer to do? And so only then can you understand, well, is there something going on that shouldn't be going on? Is there someone on the system that shouldn't be on it? Is someone trying to abuse my system? And so the easiest way to learn about that is, well, how do you get into a system? How do I hack into a computer? What are the signs that will show up when you hack into this system, right? And so that is quite crucial to understand the difference between what's normal and what is not. And while we have systems or services that we have built in the cybersecurity industry to help with that, there's still a lot of knowledge that you need to have as an analyst to interpret some of these things and figure out, is this really a true positive or is it a false positive? Is this just caused because of this other application that's running that might interfere or that might just also normally do these kinds of things? So you have to understand what's normal and how to break into the systems to understand the signals of what to look for when something bad is going on.
And of course, a lot of companies are relying, as you rightly point out, on their analysts to do just that. But the responsibility is shifting as well, isn't it, to the end user. So I need to be able to look at my machine and also try to spot whether or not, for instance, an email is real or whether or not I think it's behaving a little bit strangely today. Maybe it's a little bit slower than usual, that kind of thing. And that's one of the big challenges with awareness, isn't it, in the security space. What sort of advice or insight have you got in terms of how we can help end users become more adept at picking up on some of those security issues that, yes, an analyst would pick up, we would hope, fairly quickly, but the end user maybe not so. So how can we help the end user?
Well, Well, it's not that easy, right? I think as a vendor community, we need to build better tools to help the end user. Any software product that's written, we need to make those systems secure, right? If you're using a web browser, it needs to be as secure as possible. If you're using any application, there is a burden on the software developer to actually build secure software and make sure it's as secure as possible. But beyond that, because not all software, we can't make software 100% secure, the end users, we need to provide tools to them to help them be secure. And there is a lot of really good things out there, like EDRs, right, to help protect the endpoints, or web gateways, or intrusion detection systems, all kinds of things that help detect bad things going on. So we need to build better tools as a vendor community for security. But then at the very end, it's a defense in depth, right? Again, security software that helps detect and protect from things, but then certain things will get through, as you're mentioning, right? Fish, how do you detect a fish? Or how do you know something is malicious? And often it gets more and more complicated. So again, we need the vendors, the security tools to do better and make really solid tools. But it's also about having a little bit of an understanding and trying to figure out, well, how does a fish look? How do we train these people? And there's a few very simple things, right? And it's hard to always follow it. But if you get an email from a random person that is asking you to transmit money, well, that's probably not the smartest thing to do. So some of them are pretty obvious, but some of them are really well disguised, right? They seem to be looking to coming from your chief finance officer or someone in the finance department. It looks very legitimate, but often it's like, well, is an email enough for me to take an action? If someone says transfer $20,000, well, maybe I'm going to call this person and verify. So a lot of the things are a little bit of common sense. A lot of it is maybe also taming your own curiosity. There's an attachment in an email. Well, maybe I shouldn't open it up before checking with that sender whether that person actually sent me that attachment. So it's not always that easy, but maybe coming at it with an attitude of suspicion and maybe a little bit of, I want to say curiosity in the sense of, well, is this real or is this someone trying to play with me here? It's probably a starting point. But then again, I think from a vendor's perspective, from a security tools perspective, we got to do better to help end users make better decisions.
It's a combination of the two, isn't it? You know, you can have the best tools in the world, but if the end user still doesn't understand what they should be doing and doesn't have that level of awareness, they're not going to be as effective. So it's about how you can have those two things working together, I think is the important point there. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, because you've worked both in the private sector and also in the government sector, I wanted to ask you how you would compare working on cyber solutions in both of those different environments. You know, are there certain aspects of security from the government standpoint that perhaps private enterprises could, should learn from, integrate into what they do, and vice versa? You know, are there some lessons that we could take from the private sector and transfer those into the government sector? What are your thoughts on that as somebody who's worked in both areas?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would say that in the government sector, we've seen that there's a lot of controls, and to some degree, those controls help making systems a little more secure, because if you want to access certain data, you have to be on this, like, there's this whole secure network called CIPRNet in the government where sort of the classified information is stored. And that is a completely disconnected system from the public side. And if you want to get data from one side to the other, you have to go through these air gaps and go through very stringent procedures to actually get from one system to another, to transfer information from one side to the other. It's a little easier from the public side to go to the secure side. The other way around is getting really tricky. But that has been a fairly successful system to make sure that classified information is staying on only certain machines that have very stringent security controls on them and very high standards of security. Now, can we implement something like this in the public sector? Probably to some degree. And I think what it comes down to is information classification. And that's something that the government has done really, really well, where you will have most documents are somehow labeled as to, is this top secret, secret? Is it publicly available information? And we need to do something similar in the public sector as well, right? There's larger organizations that will find some kind of a data classification project or system in place, but often not necessarily adhere to very well. I often give the example, if you look at vendor presentations, that's something I see quite a lot, right? Like security vendor X has their sales presentation. And if you have ever seen on the bottom, it says company confidential. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, This is just data labeling gone wrong, because this is a public presentation. Why do you make it confidential? But people just use these kinds of default templates rather than thinking about and going through a process of really labeling these documents and outputs that a company has. So I think that's probably one thing we could learn quite a bit from the data labeling and data classification from the government. The other way around, I think large organizations have so many different cybersecurity programs in place. There is often lots of complexity, and different companies are using different systems and frameworks. And I think one thing that the government has done fairly well, especially if you look at the US government, is the efforts that they've led with NIST and the cybersecurity framework, with the risk assessment frameworks, with all the different control guidelines and so on, has been very successful. And actually the public sector is adopting that more and more. And it's something that will help all of us, A, building tools to those frameworks, and B, then being able to use the tools. And we can have people in between that can help teach these frameworks, can help implement them. But if we were to move more towards some of these standards, I think we have a better chance to actually build systems and combine different systems together that will really help protect an organization and their data.
You've talked there about confidentiality. You talked a little bit about sort of availability and standards and frameworks and so on. The piece that worries me the most actually is neither of those these days. It's actually the integrity of data. And I say that because we're using so much more technology from an artificial intelligence perspective, machine learning. And of course, you know, you have to be absolutely sure that the data that you're putting into those systems is real, that it hasn't been tampered with. And you made the point earlier on about, software isn't 100% secure. Data is not 100% secure either. And yet we're moving to this position where we're almost making assumptions, or some organizations might be criticized for making assumptions, that the data they're using is of a high integrity. How can we assure business leaders, people listening to this, for instance, that the integrity is a key issue? What are the steps that could be taken to protect the integrity of data?
It's a fantastic point. With the conversations about artificial intelligence and machine learning and all that, the data you're feeding these systems, especially the data you're feeding the systems to learn and then draw inferences from that, is so crucial. If there is bias in the data, if there has been malicious changes to the data, that will let your systems train the wrong things. It's an incredibly hard problem to solve. How do I know that my Excel spreadsheet hasn't been tampered with? It starts with, again, it's really data protection, right? You have to make sure that you start with access control, that only the people that should be able to access a document can access it, that only the people that should be able to edit the document can actually edit it. Not everybody that you're sharing a document with should be able to change it, right? But the hard part here is that these access controls can get really out of hand, and it's hard to make sure that the right document is only available to the people that need to have it, that only the people authorized can change the data. But I think we can do better. If I get a financial spreadsheet, for example, from finance, well, finance is the authority on the spreadsheet. I should not go in and change the data and then reshare the spreadsheet with others. And that's now the new truth, because the governor, the person or the entity that is authoritative here is finance. If I have a problem with the data, I should go back to them so that they can fix the root cause, right? So these kinds of workflows need to probably be more guarded and governed in the end. But it's really, really hard, as you're saying, right? And once I receive a document, how do I know it has not been tampered with? And one of the only ways to do that probably is if you have very, very detailed audit trails on who has accessed the data in what way. And if you see someone in that chain that should really not have touched that data, you probably want to push it back and make sure that you get the raw data again and someone can regenerate it. But it's an incredibly hard problem, and we haven't even touched on what it does to machine learning and artificial intelligence if you don't have the right data. It's not even necessarily just making sure that the data hasn't been tampered with, but even just a bias in the data is going to make a big difference.
What are some of the challenges around bias in the data from a machine learning artificial intelligence standpoint?
Well, we have seen many examples in the machine learning space where systems started learning the wrong things or started overlearning on certain areas. There's many funny examples out there of a chatbot that suddenly became racist and things like that. In the end, it's a serious problem that you're running into. And it's really hard. If I have a system that I want to teach something, how do I generate training data that's not biased? How do I make sure it really is all encompassing, that when I have, I don't know, I'm taking population data, I want to make sure that the data is not just taken from a certain area where, for example, only high net worth people live, or most of high net worth people live because there's expensive houses there. If you generate a model that should go across a generic population, well, you need to have data about a generic population that you learn on. Otherwise, the system is very biased towards this high net worth population and comes up with the completely wrong decisions. Now, for a lot of these problems in the, I call it the normal world, it's pretty easy to see that, right? You're like, yeah, okay, you shouldn't take data from this area. You should make sure that you're taking the data from the entire city or something like that, where you have a more diverse distribution of the data. But when it comes to, say, computer traffic, how do computers talk to each other and what's malicious and what is not? Well, what's the population of systems I have to take into account to get a really good cross-section of what I'm looking at? How do I know this data is clean, that I don't learn on data that has attack traffic already within? How do I know that it's not already infected traffic, for example? So it gets very hard. You have to understand what you're looking at. You have to then double check what the outputs are. And once you have a model coming out, one of the big problems of machine learning, it's this black box. It learned something, and then you can ask it questions based on what it learned. It says, is this normal or not? Or is there an attack here? The system says yes and no. It doesn't tell you, in a lot of cases, why it came up with that answer. And that's a big problem, right? Suddenly you're just relying on this black box for decisions and you're just blindly following them. And I gave a talk a number of years ago at Black Hat where I showed what actually happens and how severely wrong decisions we can make that way. And so we need to move towards systems that are explainable, systems where you can open them up and look inside and you can tell, oh, this is what the system learned. And then when it makes an inference, when it makes a decision, you can also look at that decision and say, oh, here's the reasons why. And an expert can verify, oh, yes, this makes sense. Right? And I see a huge problem coming at us with these black box learning systems.
And that's not necessarily a security issue at all, is it? It's more about the way in which we are responding or becoming overly dependent upon technology, and perhaps some might say losing the ability to think for ourselves because we're following the data perhaps too rigorously. And that really sort of takes me into this whole area, I think, of value and investment. Now, the world is a challenging place at the moment. Lots of companies are feeling the pinch. Talk of recession in many parts of Europe and the United States. We all know what happens during a recessionary time. Budgets are cut, expenses become really examined. How do you think we can better make the argument for increased data security, if that's appropriate, during such times? Because this is a question I'm getting asked a lot at the moment.
Good question. I don't know that I would attribute it just to times of recession. I think overall, we have a duty to do whatever we can on the cybersecurity front, on protecting our data, on protecting our systems. Because in the end, whatever you do, if you have a company that is relying on computer systems in any way, shape, or form, once those systems are not working anymore, your business is going to be in jeopardy. My sister has a small company, an architecture firm, and she got ransomware a couple of years ago on one of her servers. And guess what? The architects couldn't do their work anymore, right? And so that puts a number of people and their jobs and their incomes at risk. So we have a duty to keep our systems secure, whether it's time of recession or not. And yes, in a recession, it's hard because, as you're saying, right, budgets are being cut. And often security budgets are one of the first ones that are being looked at because, well, it's a risk equation, right? You're like, well, we're not going to invest right now. We're just going to hope we're not going to be attacked. But that's not working anymore. We've seen that maybe 10 years ago, it was these, I want to call them hacker groups, that would attack mostly large organizations. They would look at, oh, where can I find the most return for my actions? And they would usually go for large organizations, right? You break into an oil and gas company, you break in a large bank and try to siphon off information that you can then sell somehow for a profit afterwards. But nowadays with ransomware, you can ransom anyone. And if you hit 100 individuals and half of them are going to pay you a sum of a few thousand dollars, you actually still make some really good money. And so the underground or the criminal world has really evolved into a crazy industry that will make money no matter whether there's a recession or not. And you have to do whatever you can to protect yourself from all of these different things. And so figuring out how to keep your security budgets up, even in times of recession, is going to be incredibly important. And probably understanding how to optimize your spend and how to figure out, well, what is really needed right now and what can you wait? And that often, if we're dealing with a lot of small businesses, for them, it's engaging with the right service provider that will help guide them through, okay, look, here's where you stand today. Here's an assessment. And here is the high value things that you should be doing. You should have an endpoint protection tool in place in some way, shape, or form. You should figure out how you protect your IoT devices. You should figure out how to protect your SaaS applications. And that's usually, you can do this not for free, but hopefully in a cost-effective way as well. You don't have to go overboard and get 100 different tools and systems and assessments, but there's some simple things you can do to get fairly secure to start with.
I'm glad you mentioned the small business there, because of course, small businesses make up such a significant proportion of any organization's supply chain. And you made the point well that the cyber criminal these days is really very smart at how they can get into and attack certain organizations. Security is very often seen as an expense. Moving it into the investment bucket, you know, where it's a business investment and something, therefore, that we need to be considering perhaps on a fairly dynamic, agile way as we manage all of our different resources, for me anyways, is the way that a lot of organizations need to be moving. But the challenge remains still for the security professional to get that message across to the C-suite, to the board. What are the sorts of things that you've seen about how to position security as a worthwhile investment and something that you absolutely have to do? You've talked a little bit about it on the way through here, but some takeaways for people here who perhaps are going into, you know, meet with a board in a few days' time. What are some of the key messages that you would give them?
Overall, I'm not a big fan of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, like these FUD messages and scaring everybody, right? But to start with, ransomware has really put cybersecurity on the map for everybody. Like, I'm sure everybody that's listening knows someone that had ransomware, or they even had it themselves, right? It's a reality. It's happening to everybody. And it can happen to whatever company we're referring to here. And it's interesting. We ran a study a couple months ago, and we talked to a lot of small businesses, and 76% of these businesses said that they had been impacted by a cybersecurity attack in 2021. Wow. So this is three quarters that had some kind of an incident. And that just shows, look, everybody is in the crosshairs. This is a problem for everyone. Now the question is, well, what's the magnitude of these kinds of attacks, right? Is it, well, it's one server, a few files are encrypted. What does that mean to my business? And that really comes down to the business to figure out, well, what is my risk appetite? What do I have to make sure I protect first? How do I figure out where my critical data, where my critical systems are, right? To your point earlier, the data that needs to maintain integrity, or if I have a manufacturing floor that is absolutely critical, there are certain business processes that I have to protect. So go after those. And I think that's an argument that any security person can use that's going to the board. It's like, okay, where do we have to make the investments? Do we understand where we have to make those investments? You don't necessarily have to protect every single machine to start with, right? Start where it really has a business impact in the end. But definitely there's no shortage of stories and examples. And I talked about some of the ransomware attacks. On the other side, if you look at the regulator, there's more and more demand to have certain standards of security, right? Like depending on what you're doing, if you have certain types of data, there's the HIPAAs and PCIs of the world that regulate healthcare data. And if you're doing credit card transactions, how you have to store that information. There's a lot of different regulation where you have to have certain security in place. And finally, the next piece that gets a lot of attention right now is cyber insurance. More and more companies want to get cyber insurance, right? It's the counterweight to all the attacks happening. And to get cyber insurance is getting pretty hard. And you have to start showing that you have certain systems and processes in place to secure your organization, right? You can't just go and say, oh, I need cyber insurance and I don't have any security measures in place. They're getting more and more stringent on what you need to have. And so I think all that together is probably a pretty good argument to invest in cybersecurity still, even in a recessionary environment.
I would agree with you, of course, but I know that a lot of organizations are still finding that a bit of an uphill struggle. You make an interesting point there about cyber insurance and the fact that, in my view, at long last, insurance companies are now asking to actually see some evidence that, that people are putting in place the right processes, the right policies. They're abiding by certain frameworks. One of the things that's always puzzled me about the insurance industry is why they aren't being, in cyber I'm talking about now, is why they've decided not to be very much more prescriptive. Why not insist, for instance, on a benchmark being done? On some kind of independent audit. We have that in the financial space. Mm. What is to prevent them doing that? And, you know, insurance, the insurance industry is so large, they could do that. And that would very significantly shift the dial overnight. Why do you think they're not doing that?
I think it's because of how insurance fundamentally works, right? It's a business of math. They look at actuarial tables, they look at risks, they look at probabilities, and they come up with some kind of a loss impact. And that is how they insure anything, earthquakes, floods, whatever you name it. It's all about what's the likelihood of something happening, what's the damage, and what is it going to cost us in the end. And the same is happening on the cybersecurity side. That's how they make their company or their organization work in terms of making money. Now, cybersecurity is, in the end, pretty hard, right? We've been talking for, gosh, probably two decades in cybersecurity about security metrics and how do we measure all these different things from the controls we have in place to the threats that are coming at a company to really come up with the risk and so on. We've been having many, many discussions on how do we measure that. Now, the insurance industry would love to have a risk formula that captures everything correctly and says, oh, if you have these things in place, then the risk is going down and so on. But they're not security experts, right? They're insurance experts. So now you're slowly starting to see that some of the insurance companies and underwriters are coming about and they're like, here's what you need to have, right? You need to have EDR, MFA, and a few other things because they realize that those different technologies are going to help them. But then if you go back to them and say, yeah, but I don't have an EDR. I have all these other security tools on my endpoint that are just as good. They can't measure that. They don't know how to compare that, right? Which you can't fault them. It's hard. So I think to answer your question, right, it's a math problem to start with. And I'm starting to see that the cyber insurance industry is starting to engage with the security vendors and with the security industry in general to come up with guidelines, with requirements. They're starting to demand certain frameworks to be in place, certain things to be shown, certain reports to be delivered to them, even if it's just at the time of application for cyber insurance, they want to start seeing some proof. And we're starting to see that depending on what you have in place, they will give you a better rate. So we're slowly moving to that, but it's a really, really hard problem to solve.
But at least we're moving in the right direction.
Right? I think so, yeah.
Rafi, we've covered a whole range of different topics here. It's been fascinating talking to you. If you could leave listeners with just one key message for something that they could do to improve their data security, What would that message be?
Oh, boy, you're putting me on the spot here. I think I will split it into two areas. One, for individuals, I get a lot of questions from friends and family, like, what can we do to be more secure? And it's just a few very simple things, right? Keep your systems up to date with software. If there's a software update, please install it. There's a reason that there is a software update. It probably makes your system more secure. Use different passwords for different systems. Please don't use the same password for LinkedIn that you're using for online banking, because when LinkedIn gets hacked, those passwords leak and people will start using them for your online banking access. And then just be critical when you're getting certain emails with attachments or links, and try to, if it sounds too good to be true, it's probably not true. I literally, 2 days ago, I saw this advertisement on Facebook for these expensive ski jackets. It was like 90% off. I'm like, I got to get one of these. And then I was like, wait a second, 90% off this brand. So I Googled it and it showed up. It's like, it's a scam. Don't fall for it. So just be critical. Again, if it's too good to be true, it probably is not true, unfortunately. That's for the individuals. And then I think on the business side, whether it's a small business or a large organization, think about security, not just in the ways that you have been thinking about it all day long, or like, oh, I need to protect my endpoint and my network and my SaaS and cloud. That's all important. But there's another way to look at it as well, which is look at it from a data perspective. In the end, most of the things that you really care about is data. As you mentioned, right, Steve, it's the integrity of the data. It's in some cases, the confidentiality, it shouldn't leak out, or just the availability of certain systems. But if you focus on how do you understand where is your critical data, how do you protect that data, you're actually shrinking the focus of your security efforts, not having to protect every single system that you have, but protecting the data very closely and tracking what's happening to the data. If you can bring it down to that, I think your life is going to be much easier. I'll leave it at that.
That's great. Some really good tips there, Rafi. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to me and obviously to the listeners. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to this week's guest, Rafael Marti. Listeners, you might be interested in the ISF's report, Protecting the Crown Jewels, How to Secure Mission Critical Assets. You can find that at securityforum.org. Along with all of ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. We'll be back with a new episode in a week. In the meantime, as always, we ask that you take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening and give us a 5-star rating. If you have a little more time, you can even write a quick review. That helps other listeners who might enjoy our content find us. And we also want to make sure to introduce you to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen. And, of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Thanks for listening.